If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 15th of November, 2019. On the podcast today, Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Petroleum, SAVP, discusses a significant milestone for them, the completion of the Seven Energy transaction. I think it's been going for around about 2 years. We talk about that on the podcast there. Nuno Sacramento, Chief Operating Officer of SafeStay, talks about the acquisition of Hotel Auberge in central Berlin, which takes their hostel network to 18. Also, Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals, EUZ, explains why they are undertaking a further diamond drilling campaign at their zinc-lead-silver project in Spain. I also have Russ Mould. Hasn't been here for a while. He's been quite busy, but Russ Mould is back on talking about global growth signals and Metro Bank. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, don't forget, if you have the app, if you haven't got the app, download it. It's free. Vox Markets app. Search for it to your app store and basically you get notifications free to the front screen of your phone. Any company you hit the follow button on, any news or release will be sent to your front screen. And obviously you can share that and stuff. But if you do get an RNS and you like the contents there, hit that thumbs up button. If you want to give it more publicity, it'll get more publicity by being listened to on the podcast, and also it'll feature on the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Petroleum, SAVP. Andrew, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Justin. Much appreciated.
It's a biggie. It's the RNS. I'm sure lots of shareholders have been asking about and saying, when is it going to happen? It's the completion of the Seven Energy transaction. There must be a lot of smiley, happy faces around Savannah Petroleum, isn't there?
Yeah, everybody's very happy in all their offices. London, Niger, and Nigeria. It's a very, very good day for the company, and it surely are. Yeah, it's the basis for which we're going to be able to hopefully kick on now and deliver a lot of value.
Okay, well, before we get, we'll dig into what, I mean, if people are new to the company, we'll get the introduction here, and we'll also go into the significance of this, if people are behind the curve. But first and foremost, Henry, just give a summary of Savannah Petroleum for people not that familiar with the company.
Okay, so Savannah Petroleum is an AIM-listed company. We started off in Niger. We've got a very, very high-quality asset in the Republic of Niger, where we've made five exploration discoveries out of five wells that we've drilled. We then made the strategic decision to move into Nigeria. We've just acquired a large-scale production business in Nigeria that ultimately supplies about 10% of the installed power supply in the country. And that is what we're announcing this morning, that transaction has now completed, which unlocks the cash flows in those assets and really a whole load more growth opportunities in Nigeria for us alongside what we have in Niger. So it's very much a transformational day for our business.
Absolutely. Were you just saying, I mean, I was surprised. I know it'd been the corporate side had been going for a long time. It's quite complex and you changed the deal a lot. But you say it's from start to finish, it's been about 2 years. Is that right?
Yeah, because look, what happened was, like, we have to take advantage of opportunity as it comes our way. In the case of this transaction, Seven Energy as a company of itself got itself into a lot of financial distress. So we had to restructure everything. So things we did included reducing the debt balance very materially and then putting in payment, better revenue assurance by getting payment guarantees for the gas sales that the business was doing. And that took some time. Also, Seven's other problem was it didn't really operate the gas value chain, whereas what we did was we amended the deal terms over time with the local partners to buy out minority interests and also to gain operatorship and control throughout the value chain. And that has put the business in a very strong position now to control its own destiny, decide what it does, when it does it, and to really start to kick on. And I'm expecting to add to that revenue line going forward.
Yeah, and even though, I mean, you mentioned that even though you've done a lot in the last 2 years, the share price is below where it was like 2 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah. I mean, the share price is below where it was when we announced the deal, and it's also, we've made five discoveries in Niger since we announced the deal. So yeah. There's been a lot of progress in the Nigerian business and the Niger business along the period, and I think part of the process now is that the transaction was complex. It had to be complex, or a company like Savannah wouldn't be able to do it, or it wouldn't have been as attractive. Now that we've completed that transaction, the business itself is super simple. The assets are very, very simple to understand. The business units are very, very simple. The business model is very, very simple. And it's now a process, I guess, that we've got an obligation upon us is to get out there and to explain to people what our business does and how we believe it creates value and how it will grow in the future going forward. And like, and to that end, we've appointed new corporate brokers to help us in that process. We appointed a firm called Numis. We appointed a firm called Jefferies. We have a good existing corporate broker and coverage, but we really felt that it would benefit from somewhat of an enhancement, and that's what we've got. So I think now the transaction has closed. We're in a position where we can now just focus on letting people focus more on explaining to people what we do in a much more simple way, and then just growing the existing businesses that we have. It's quite an exciting time.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the operations now rather than the corporate side, which is good to know. And like you say, growing that. So, okay. And so looking forward now, I mean, Andrew, in the next sort of 6-12 months, what are you hoping to achieve?
So I think what we would hope to achieve is we're in the process of working out what we're going to do in this year, next year. But clearly what we've indicated in the past is that we want to start deliver first oil from the existing discoveries that we have and then recommence exploration activity. With the closure of the Seven transaction, that enables us to focus on sort of putting that together and really just getting that business back into an activity mode, and that's a core focus. In terms of in Nigeria, the assets that we're buying are the only assets of a type in the part of the country that we're in, and it's a very high demand growth thing, power, and therefore we expect that we should be able to cater for additional customers. By adding those customers, we have installed capacity in place to be able to do it. We just need to sign up those customers. And Seven, when it was in a distressed position, was not in a position to do that. We hope to change that and to quickly move towards signing up additional customers. So that will be our core focus. So in the next 6 months, that's, I guess, what we're really focusing upon. And then longer term, we're in countries where there's a lot of opportunity for businesses like ourselves to grow inorganically as well as organically. But that's not the core near-term focus. The core near-term focus is to stabilise the business and to put the existing businesses back on the growth mode.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of opportunity now across the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, you know the score, Andrew. If someone is now listening to this and they've been following the story but have been waiting for this deal to get done and they need a little bit of convincing maybe, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think firstly, if you were to look at the analyst research that's published on us, it's clear that we trade at a very significant discount to the analyst perception of value and certainly the company's perception of its value. And a lot of that has been to do with, I guess, a perceived uncertainty around the transaction. But now that should hopefully be behind us and people can focus on what's happening in the business and what's going to happen in the business going forward. specifically what's going to happen, you have in the Niger business, the business model is really straightforward. We estimate it costs about $1 a barrel to find oil, and the discoveries are worth up to $6 a barrel. So that's a really good capital investment business, but more importantly, we expect to be able to very quickly put discoveries that we make on stream within an accelerated time frame. And then in Nigeria, it's all about taking advantage of the inbuilt capacity that we have, the spare capacity that we have, and adding additional gas volumes over time, as well as looking at other opportunities on an opportunistic basis. So that's really those three reasons. What I would say is, if someone is new to understanding our business, I always point people to the shareholder letter in this year's annual report, which is on, I believe, pages 6 to 9, which really talks about where we came from, what we've done, and what we're looking to do in the future. There's a very good corporate presentation that we have, and our Twitter account also provides a lot of updates, especially media type updates, which aren't necessarily picked up by the mainstream media. So I would just encourage people to get in touch as well. Like, we have an active IR function that's very responsive and very, very keen to take questions and help people start to understand our business and why we think we're going to add a lot of value.
Yeah, all the stuff. Good stuff, Andrew. It's good to chat to you. Like you say, you know, it's all about the operations now. So hopefully we'll be chatting on a regular basis. Look forward to speaking very soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Just one thing, Justin, before you go. I think it's important that I publicly thank all the staff that have helped us deliver this, our advisory team, the stakeholders that we've been dealing with in Nigeria, our partners, government, etc., etc. It's been fantastic to work with them and really to get to this milestone in our development. I mean, I think everybody should be very happy.
Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Andrew.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nuno Sacramento, Chief Operating Officer of SafeStay, SSTY is the ticker there. Nuno, thanks for joining me.
Justin, thank you so much for having me. I spoke to you, a fortnight ago?
Yes.
And we've got some more news, so it's great to be.
Absolutely. Racking up those acquisitions. We'll dig into the detail of it in a bit. But before we do, let's not run before we can walk. For people not familiar with SafeStay, can you just explain what SafeStay is, please, Nuno?
Well, SafeStay is the only listed hostel company in the world, we believe. And what we're doing is we're consolidating the hostel market with a fabulous network of Safe, that is in the name, and we think it's important in hostels, Stylish, and then quality and service-focused products, because the hostel market is coming from behind, needs to catch up with where the hotel market is. And in fact, we see all the parallels of the budget hotel market 20, 30 years ago in the hostel market, waiting for someone to come in and consolidate it with a credible brand. And we think with those people, we're going to be consolidating the market with a fabulous brand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I've always said this, check out the website there. You can obviously book through there, but it gives you a gallery of some of the hostels you have at the moment. Very smart, like you say, nice brand, nice colours. And it's not for me. When I used to travel years ago and I stayed in a hostel, if I could stay in a hostel like yours when I was younger, I would have, but there's nothing about like that. So it's nice to see that that's available now. Okay, let's get into the news today. Another acquisition. What's happening here?
Well, so the last time I came to speak to you, it was all about Venice. Venice is a long-term project because we acquire the land, we acquire the property. We entered a joint venture to develop the property. Very big, 600 bedrooms. It will take a while to come into play. Berlin is the opposite. It's a key tourist city. We want to be here, 13 million visitors each year. And the hotel is right in the center of the town by a shopping center that some of your listeners will recognize, called KDV. It's absolutely perfect. This one is a leasehold. So we're trying to create a great mixture of freeholds, leaseholds, long leaseholds, and have a strong pipeline of development projects. That will give us a good balance in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. Now, leaseholds allow us to expand at a fast pace throughout Europe with operating platforms that become immediately cash accretive. So that to us is really, really important. This year we did three freeholds: Pisa, Glasgow, and Venice. Pisa immediately became a contributor. Glasgow immediately becomes a revenue contributor. Venice will take a little bit longer. And this one has a leasehold, which we think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? Back in the summer, I think you're at 14 hostels, and you said, I think it was in 13 just before that. And you're saying, yeah, we're hoping to get like 20 by this time next summer. And it took a little while, but now you are motoring. Now you've got 18 hostels. And like you say, you know, one of your trademarks here is making sure the locations are spot on. Like you've got Glasgow, Edinburgh, York, and London, now Athens, Brazil, Lisbon, Madrid, Paris, Pisa, Prague, Venice, Vienna, and Barcelona, and also now in Berlin. So it's a cracking acquisition there. Go on.
Let me just make a point on that. We've got a great network, and that's what's becoming so exciting. Yeah. They're all complementary. We've got the Safe Stay Pass coming out this year, which is traveling through Interrail in all of our key locations. And because they're close enough, you can easily do that. We've got £999 for a month with Interrail included. So it's a great value product. But for us, it's important that we're buying the right locations and we're buying the right business models. Mm-hmm. We're doing this in the right way because we're investing our investors' money and we're concerned with generating value for shareholders. So this is not an ego trip. We're not trying to create anything to pat ourselves on the back. We're trying to create shareholder value, but very focused on the guests. The guest for us is the central point of all of these. But we're very proud, and Berlin is absolutely a city we had to be in. It's 150 beds, so it's not a large platform, but we wanted to be present in Germany, kind of find out what the challenges are in terms of licensing laws, employment laws, with a low risk product in a great city, and then from there grow the platform in Germany, which is a great country for us.
Yeah. And do you find now you're getting maybe to that point, you're getting, you know, largest, or, you know, you obviously 18 hostels now, but are you getting third parties approach you, or are you having constant, conversation, dialogue with these people, or third parties?
And that's the thing. Online travel agents, a lot of the groups agents, because hostels are naturally applicable for groups. We're becoming well-known as the network grows, but we're also becoming an important partner, a valuable partner for them. As we look at the volume of business that we do with some of these agents, mm-hmm. It's so easy to now get a meeting with them. It's so easy to now negotiate prices from a different standpoint, because as the network grows, we become more valuable to them, and we become easier to work with them as well, because there's a contact point that they recognize, and then they use in 4 or 5 different locations, rather than having to piecemeal it across various different individual privately owned businesses. So yes, there's an absolute value in negotiating better and then becoming a valued partner for a lot of the agents.
Yeah. And what at the moment, the hostel market, what's it like? Is it growing fast? Because I know, of late we've had Airbnb come on the scene of last 5-10 years, and that stole a bit of thunder there. But what's the hostel market like at the moment?
Well, Airbnb has some noise around it, but then not even a direct competitor. Airbnb is about the lack of service and coming in and being able to not be seen and not be handled by anyone. Our business is completely different. It's about the vibrance. It's the public areas. It's the fact that you're meeting people. And you make the compromise of staying in a dorm, but you get great value to be able to be in great locations. You've got millennials. Millennials travel 4 times a year. They spend 50% of their income in leisure experiences. So we're so resilient because we've got millennials. But now we've got Generation Zers as well. And Generation Zers are a different demographic. But again, they're invested in traveling more. And so they will be value conscious. And we're putting a great product in front of people. It's not hostels as you knew it. It's a good quality product with great linen, a bed that is made for you, good quality mattress, a good quality bed in a great environment.
Yeah, and I suppose, like you said, the more you acquire and the I suppose the more experienced you get at this business, and the better the product becomes, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the growth is now in the DNA of the team. I'm in Berlin talking to you, the team comes in, everybody kind of knows what they need to do. They know how they will improve the value of the business we've just acquired. But equally, immediately, we know how we drive value for our guests. You know, what is the right distribution of beds? How do we create a great product without just cheapening the value for our users?
Yeah, it's good that this is immediately, you know, income accretive. So going forward, you did say you had a target of 20 I suppose it's getting short term now, but by summer so next year. And that's looking quite achievable now, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's so straightforward now. With 18 properties in the portfolio, getting to 20 by the summer, which was the initial objective, that is, we'll smash that. I'm very confident. We're looking at 40 different locations where we think the safe state pass I was telling you about, we think there are 40 locations that are no more than 2 hours away from each other that create a great network for us to be a captive product for Generation Z and millennials. So yes, very, very exciting.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Nunu. Well, as always, if someone's listening, likes the sound of what you're doing here, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we're an experienced business, and the first thing I would ask your listeners to do is to go into our Instagram page. It's SafeStay at Instagram. It's that straightforward. We've got this fast growth proven model, and we're pan-European with a network of 18 properties, and we're delivering a safe stay, it's in the name, well-designed, quality, service-led hostel experience that stands out, and that will give us longevity as a product. We've got a really resilient performance due to our demographic, and I told you about the millennials and Generation Zs. They're not intimidated by world events. They don't seem to be the target of anything. If anything, they will be using hostels if there is any kind of event that interests their population. So a very, very resilient product. We're having a fantastic year, not feeling any attrition from the Thomas Cook's events and so on and so forth. And it's a cash generative business. And that makes us very efficient as we grow. And Justin, grow we will, you know that, because I talk to you every fortnight with a new property. Yeah. We're doing it with caution, very focused on consolidating the best hostel network in Europe. But we'll do it at a pace because the market is there for the taking.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, Nunu, well, listen, like I say, yeah, you've been a regular on the podcast almost in the last few months, so it's, hopefully we'll be hearing from you in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals. That's EUZ ticker. Lawrence, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Hey.
Now, you've got a bit of news out today. Drilling mobilization and operational updates on your Tural project there, your zinc lead silver project in Spain. And we'll get into that as always. But what I'd like to do, Lawrence, you know this, if someone's not familiar with Europa or has listened to the podcast the first time today, just summarize what you're about, please, if you could.
Lead zinc silver project, which we've rapidly progressed towards a development stage, which can be got up running with low capex, with nice looking operating margins. And we've de-risked an awful lot of it in terms of resource, and we're now going into key metallurgical work, which is coming up very shortly.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, so explain this drilling campaign. You've got a new drilling campaign, a diamond drilling campaign. Why is that? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone's always excited by a drilling campaign, but I think there's other bits of the announcement which I think are almost equally as exciting. But it's a drilling campaign which is going to target to the immediate west of the current indicated resource, so still inside the inferred resource. And the idea is to start expanding the key mining zone. So if you look at the scoping study that we announced last year, This is the area which forms the core of what would be mined. So again, we've recently updated and announced a great initial indicated resource. And again, we've talked about it before, Justin. We're looking at filling in the gaps. We're looking at the most cost-effective and valuable work that we can do. And that clearly must be trying to fill in the gaps of existing drill patterns or inferred, mm-hmm. turn them into indicated for the minimum amount of money, and seeing if we can join up a single bigger block of contiguous indicated.
Okay, understand. And take us through the geotechnical and hydrogeological programs. Why is that important then, Lawrence?
Well, we're at a very different time from where we were this time last year when we spoke in Justin, or even, 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. You know, the resource has been established, it's got indicated, that can just happily be built out if we choose to. But what we're really looking into is how do you mine it? And how do you progress towards a mine plan? So, geotechnical and hydrogeological work, they aren't exciting. It does all sound rather boring and technical, but it's crucially important. And we spent some time last week in Spain sitting around with the whole team, really asking the questions about, right, if we need to progress this into mine, what are we missing? What do we need to know? What do we think we know? We have reports on, we need to prove. So geotechnical surveying started about a week and a half ago. And again, I think Europa's pretty good at utilizing what we've got in front of us rather than spending lots of money on new equipment or new processes. We got the guys into the adits, so the old lid workings at the surface of Taral, because if you remember, the resource pretty much goes all the way to the top. It's just we're focusing on the high grade low down, and started surveying the rock, and that work will continue with more detailed work, putting piezometers, and how do you mine it? How do you actually go about extracting the ore you need from the rock in the most cost efficient manner? And, the hydrogeological stuff is not just stuff. It's highly important work for two reasons. If you actually want to develop a mine meaningfully in the 21st century, it's all about water. It's about water for two reasons. Is that, is your project appropriate to the local region? How's it going to affect, if at all, local water conditions? And this work has to be done. I think we've got a real advantage in Spain because there's a clear regulatory framework around that, and also we're in an existing mining region. And the second reason we need to do this work, we've got a fairly good idea, we think, of what the water conditions would be subsurface, i.e. you can't mine anything if it's chock-a-block full of water anywhere in the world. So we think we're pretty safe on that, but what we need to do is test it, and we're going to do this important work so we can go out and say, if we start mining, this will be the water conditions, and it's all economic and should be put into development.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. And talk us through, of course, the metallurgy work there. How's it all going?
It's going really well. I think the key thing for shareholders, the last bit on that section, which is we're on schedule for Q4 as we commence and complete the lock cycle test work. We've got a bit more detail in there about some of the other elements that we've gone through metallurgical testing, Wyward, L. Armstrong, but in a sense that's we just want to put a place marker in there about the type of work that we've been doing for if you like perhaps a wider audience as we go forward, and ahead of us announcing the full report once we received it on the Met work, which we're quite excited about.
I've seen a couple of people mention Lundin. We'll talk about that, but them getting through the back door and stuff. Can you explain, first of all, people not aware of this chatter, what it's about, and that idea getting through the back door here? What's going on?
No, certainly. I mean, I'm not going to talk about Lundin. It would be inappropriate for me to. Basically, we inherited a previous agreement with Lundin. Lundin historically did a lot of work on the project. And there's a concern, though, that I've seen amongst some shareholders that Lundin might think about coming into the back door of Terraal and taking a percentage of the asset and the project. Now, what I would probably say to that is it's not something that particularly worries me, that particular element. And I'd probably say to shareholders, go and look on the Lundin website and look at their Spanish mine, Neves-Corvo, and have a look at that and have a look at the amount it produces per annum. And I would probably, the question I'd ask is, looking at that and the production rates and the size of the production Lundin involve themselves in, would they want a percentage of a project of Terraal size at present? Would that be of any of use to them? And I'd argue probably no. So I just, it's a good question because it's I've seen it going around, but I honestly, it's not something that particularly concerns me because in my experience, big major companies, they're looking for a certain type of asset. If they're going to invest the time and money and effort into developing that asset, the last thing they want is to be mired in a potentially competitive situation, especially with a junior company, which big companies don't really like doing in actual fact. Yeah. What they'd much rather is a collaborative agreement going forward or an outright purchase. Now, none of those discussions have been had at all, but I'm just saying in terms of sneaking in the back door, is there going to be, I just don't see it as credible. That's my opinion.
Marvellous stuff. Okay. As always, Lawrence, then, if someone is listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not yet following the story, just give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add Europa Metals to their watch list, please.
You've got a massively exciting lead zinc silver market. We're about to announce lead zinc silver concentrate results, and we're in a mining region, but in a country which is supporting mining, and where you aren't going to see your project subjected to arbitrary windfall tax, we think, or be taken away and nationalised, which is one of the big problems in mining right now. So I think safe, solid, good place near metals markets, near smelters, and really looking forward to seeing what we can produce from this mine. And a lot of the hard yards now already done.
Marvellous stuff. Lawrence, thanks for that, fella. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Very well, Justin. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I say that, I give you a title there. I assume it hasn't changed. We haven't spoken for a while.
No, we haven't. Sorry, there's been a bit of a three-month interregnum. I've been involved in a couple of big projects here for our major financial advisor conference that took place yesterday. I write a sort of market overview come preview document, and it's 25 to 30,000 words. There's 12 fund manager interviews in it. So, I've met Sebastian Lyon of Troy. I've met Edward Bonham Carter of Jupiter and some seriously good fund managers. So it's been great fun, but it's very time consuming. So unfortunately, I've not been able to do the research I wanted to do to provide some comment on this. But now, hopefully, I know we've got the run into Christmas and everything, but hopefully I'm back on board now. So thank you for having me back.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one glad to see you back. I mean, someone keeps tweeting all the time saying, "Where's Russ? He's the best thing on the podcast."
Oh, now that's flattery. We'll get you everywhere, Justin.
Exactly.
Have you met my dad?
I was going to say, remember your family. So let's talk about some macro stuff, and then we'll chat.
Sure.
I saw an article on Metro Bank as well. You did, so I'd be interested to see your take on Metro Bank. But yesterday, I don't know if you saw those figures from China. China industrial production came out as not very good. And then they had things like the retail sales, worst in 16 years, and fixed asset investment, worst ever. Well, now that is not good in anyone's book, is it really?
No, and it's intriguing. One of the presenters at our Rivadger event yesterday, and I won't mention his name in case his compliance department go potty, one of his themes was I know people are worrying about Japanification in the West in terms of debt, demographics, falling populations and deflation. He's actually worried about China and Japanification, because he thinks a lot of the trends are the same. You've got a lot of debt in the system, although Chinese government debt is very low at 40 to 50% of GDP. There's an awful lot of debt that's sort of in the netherworld between government and Chinese state-owned enterprises. So in that respect, there's a lot more debt in the system than you think. You've got the shadow banking system. You've got consumer debt's gone up a lot. So China has piled on the debt, and it looks as if, because of the one-child policy, the population's peaking out. So they do have some of the issues that we've got. And I think China is continuing to try and, as indeed a Western authorities and central bank, juggle many things at once, which is balancing trying to achieve growth, and yet at the same time, when they pump lots of cheap money into the system, they don't want it all going into the stock market and property speculation. And so they've been trying to, and at the same time, they're trying to defend their currency. They don't want their currency to go down in a straight line, because that will upset their American friends, shall we say, and that would probably be seen by the President Trump and his colleagues as currency manipulation, and probably bring further wrath upon them. So I think those numbers is one of the reasons why stock markets, bond markets are convinced there will be a quick deal between America and China to resolve this trade dispute, which is building up to this crescendo of the 15th of December, and it's about another 15% tariffs and about another $150 odd billion of Chinese goods coming up. And that's one of the reasons why stock markets are rising, because they're convinced that there's going to be a deal, because President Xi needs one to get Chinese growth going, and President Trump, they think, needs one because he's got an election to fight in November 2020. It's tricky. Yeah. I mean, Trump's been promising a deal since the Buenos Aires G20 meeting exactly this time last year. It's not happened yet. I personally think he probably will be relatively cynical about it and make sure that there is some sort of deal at a politically and economically convenient juncture. But he can't give away too much or back off, because that would probably be a bone for the Democrats, and also potentially offend some of his voter base. President Xi needs a deal, but look, the Chinese don't operate on a one-year view. They operate on a 50, 100-year view or longer. And I think, they might just think, we'll run this one out and try and make life awkward for Trump and see if we can get rid of him, because they probably would prefer negotiating with President Biden or President Bloomberg rather than President Trump. So I wouldn't be shocked if the Chinese were to string this along a little bit and try and apply some leverage, given that the other president's got an election to fight next year.
Yeah, but do you know what? I was just thinking, how much pressure is President Xi feeling from not only in the economy, but it plays into it as well, but Hong Kong's imploding. It's getting worse. I mean, it seems no end to it.
Hong Kong is a strange one, because I know the UK handed over control as per the deal in 1997, but there's been very little comment on that in the UK financial press or generally, and I think, or politically. I know politically the whole country's in ferment still. We've got a general election coming, we've still got Brexit, but under normal circumstances you would have expected this to be a big deal given the long history, and I think UK politicians have just filed it in the too difficult bucket. Because there's been so little comment on it. The UK there's virtually nothing that the UK can do to influence China. Economically, maybe a little bit, but I think it's just going. And also, the UK is very reliant on, like a lot of countries, on Chinese foreign direct investment and Chinese money flowing in. And I think it's just been put in the too difficult bucket. You do look at Hong Kong and wonder if it will ever be quite the same again in some ways. And, President Xi overnight was saying to Carrie Lam, the governor of Hong Kong, that, we're looking for some hard action from you, young lady. So I think that's a very, very intractable situation. The Communist Party's legitimacy rests on employment and growth, and without that, they've got a major problem. So I think they will keep on spinning, trying to keep the plate spinning, whether it's through monetary policy or fiscal policy. But you're right, it's a problem for the Aussie economy. It's a problem for the miners, and it was one of the slides I put up yesterday, just looking at the 10 biggest stocks worldwide by market cap on the 1st of January 2010 were basically all commodity, oil, or China players. And that's not really worked out that well this decade. You know, the Chinese growth story is going to the sun. The oil price hasn't dropped back anywhere near its peaks. Industrial metal prices, with the exception of palladium right now, and possibly nickel because of some local issues in Indonesia, are generally under pressure. So that story hasn't worked out so well. And so the only point I was making was, well, look, ladies and gentlemen, these seven biggest stocks in the world right now are all technology companies.
Yeah.
So just be a little bit careful of extrapolating your experience from the last decade to the next one, because things that work for one decade don't, you know, it's in the price and everybody knows the narrative, and there'll be a surprise from someplace, whether it's regulation or competition, whatever it happens to be. You know, the fangs might not have it all their own way in the next decade, and certainly if Elizabeth Warren becomes president, then you can pretty much guarantee that's a certainty, because I don't think she's been much of an experienced legislator, but she's been an experienced regulator, so she could definitely, I think, feel the inclination to stick a roar in if she gets the chance.
Yeah, things are changing. So is it, I mean, looking at wider numbers, figures, oh, by the way, just on the off today, I mean, I just did see a release today, which is telling, really, talking about the change in favour of industries. The EU is stopping funding now oil, gas and coal projects, €2 billion a year, so that's very telling. Yeah. And we had Norwegian sovereign fund as well doing that a while back. But is there any numbers or figures you're looking around, you know, in the macro environment that either present a bright light in the future or gloomy, or what?
It was actually a lot of what my presentation, our event was yesterday. It was about the five indicators I put up are the ones I use regularly. We've talked about some of them individually. So they're a combination of economic indicators and sort of market indicators. So looking at the five that I put up, the first one is Dr. Copper.
Yeah.
Good guide to the global health, global economy's health, because copper's used everywhere in buildings, automobiles, it's malleable, it's ductile, and it's pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And that price has not been very strong this year. It's stuck at $5,500 a ton. It's not going anywhere fast, but it's not collapsing. So you'd say that's a bit of a mixed signal.
Yeah.
The other economic one that I look at are the transport indices, the Dow Jones Transport Index, the industrials and the S&P are at record highs, the transports isn't. Richard Russell's Dow theory suggests you need the transports to follow through, if not to even lead. Because if the economy is strong, stocks and shelves need to be refilled and inventory needs to be moved. And if the economy is not strong, then that's not the case. And that will show up in transport stocks.
Yeah.
And US heavy truck holders are very weak. This again could all just be tariff and trade related.
Yeah.
So again, it shows how, you know, just psychologically, if there is a deal, you can see how it could quickly filter through.
Yeah.
Small caps, the Russell 2000 isn't at a new all-time high yet, so there's a little bit of reticence there. Again, that probably just reflects economic softness in the US and how reticence over trade and tariffs. So copper, small caps and transport, I will say, are okay, but not awesome. Not as strong, perhaps, as you would be led to believe, given the way stock markets are performing. The one that's going gangbusters is the SOX index, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index. That's silicon chips that we've talked about. Chips are in everything from your phone to your smart meter to your car, to your fridge, to your rate. I mean, they're just everywhere. So they're a good economic indicator, and they're also a pretty good risk appetite indicator, because they're momentum jockey stocks. They feed off upgrades, and they panic when they see downgrades. So it's good to see that doing well. And the five indicators, chips are good, copper, small caps, transport, meh. And the one that's not good is banks, because they are struggling. And we'll come on to Metro in a minute. But the banking indices have not done well this year. Again, I know they've had a bit of a rally since August with this value rally, in fairness. But they're struggling. And a lot of that just comes down to the fact that the things that the banks need to really make money are positive interest rates, a steep yield curve, and wide credit spreads. And they haven't got any of them right now. So it's pretty tough to be a bank. And this is the Japanification theme. If you run the Japanese banks index since the market peaked in 1989, the Topix banks index is down a mere 90%. And if you look at that, basically the banks index follows the yield curve down generally. But I mean, have been phenomenal rallies, I hasten to add. So if you are, I don't want to be fighting the last war by telling people to look at banks to spot the next economic crisis, if there is one. But you know, if you look at how Japanese banks traded, when people did think Japan was getting growth back and getting inflation back, they rallied hard. There was a big rally 2003-06 when Japanese banks basically tripled. And that's the kind of thing that value hunters are looking for right now. So we'll see. But I think banks are struggling right now. If you do get interest rates going up because the economy is okay and inflation's picking up, the banks are the logical place to play that. The big five UK banks are trading at around book value or less, so they're definitely in value territory, and they're unloved, you know, because the environment's really tough. But so it won't take a lot to change sentiment on them. It won't take a lot to get the numbers going up. But at the moment, you're just seeing downgrades. And PPI is done, but you're still seeing downgrades because the environment is not good for them. And the Japanese banks are living proof. Now, history isn't guaranteed to repeat itself. But if you look at the chart of European and UK banks relative to their 2-10s yield curves, exactly the same trend you see in Japan. They follow it up and they follow it down. And therefore, generally, they're following it down right now.
Yeah. Well, explain this one then. I mean, we are seeing a lot of trouble around the world, you know, macro worries and threats and trade deals and all this stuff. I mean, you know, but yet the American stock markets are at their all-time high. So yep. That doesn't tend to reflect the global sentiment, doesn't it?
I guess markets love to climb a wall of worry, right?
Mm-hmm.
They climb the wall of worry and then they slide down the slope of hope. So, you know, they like worries. And at the moment, the US market is convinced that the trade talks will be resolved. B, the Fed has got their back because it's cut interest rates 3 times. It's got stuck into the repo market to keep that calm. Overall, the UK economy is okay. It's not brilliant, but it's probably the least dirty shirt in the laundry in that it's still showing growth and it's got an accommodative central bank. And so and overall, corporate number earnings are actually flat, but because investor relations seem to have been smart, that you've still got earning companies beating estimates. And you've got huge share buyback schemes still being run. So that's a massive source of net support for the market. So I can see why it's happened, because interest rates have gone down, but he's looking for a home and all those things. And you've got a president who is, you know, making all the right noises about, you know, trying to get the economy going. So people are buying into that. But if he doesn't deliver and earnings start to disappoint, you have a potential problem, because, you know, looking at long-term valuations like Case-Shiller, or lots of other ways you can do it, the US stock market's basically in the top 5 percentile points of its valuations all time, and that's not a great time to be buying normally, but it's been the only game in town for the last 10 years, and it's very hard to see what's going to change that. But that's, of course, when things are probably at the most dangerous, when making money's easy. So I'm not saying don't be involved in US equities. It's a dynamic entrepreneurial economy, phenomenally well-run companies, very tightly run, very shareholder-focused, very shareholder-centric. So you can see why it's done well. Compared to, say, Europe, dare one say, where I think there are different political and philosophies at work, which you may or may not believe is appropriate. So I can see why the background is good, but I do worry about valuation. And I do worry that these trade talks are not going to be as simple to resolve as people think. Equally, I'm sure that Trump is perfectly capable of bending that narrative to his political will if he feels the need to try and maximise his chances for re-election next November.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to Metro Bank, because you know, I was someone flagged this up to me and they took with their book value, and I was quite taken with it. I had a
little The book value was £10.20 a share, I think, Justin.
Yeah. Well,
share price is £2.
Yeah. Well, I do know. I decided to have a little punt, and I looked into it further, and I thought, oh no, and I sold out, and I said several reasons. Essentially, they can't afford their bonds. They've got
this is why the shares are trading at 0.2 times book, because they've just had to do that bond at about 15% interest rate. So the book value, that's going to kill their profitability. So the book value is going to go down. Is the counter argument to that? Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, I looked at the last release, and everything going forward immediately was basically the margins were getting worse. And the one thing they championed was their new customers, and that they had to pay for that because it cost them money. And it did give them an extra bit of. But so that's going down as well. So the next news release will be bad. But the thing that everyone's saying, private investors, is that, oh, it'll be taken out. Lloyds will buy it. But I thought this is a challenger bank.
That was the Evening Standard story, wasn't it?
A rumour, yes.
Story that Lloyds were snuffling around. I mean, you can see why you think somebody would look at buying it at 0.2 times book. But as you say, the problem is that it's in loss, and they've got that very heavy debt of 15% on the to make sure that they meet all the capital adequacy requirements. It's a difficult situation. I think what you're lacking at the moment is positive momentum in terms of news flow. You had the accounting misclassification of assets, which led to them having to raise more capital, back off on their growth targets, raise that expensive funding, push out the chairman and founder. And as you said, if you read the Q3 statement, it said, you know, we're going to give an update on our growth targets at the full year numbers, and we will be balancing those growth targets with our capital adequacy requirements and our financial requirements, which read to me that they're going to be backing off on the growth targets again. So I think the good news from the third quarter numbers was is that you didn't actually see customers withdrawing their money. I think customer deposits were up 4% sequentially. And I think after you did see those rather dramatic pictures in the summer of people queuing up outside Metro Bank in North London somewhere to get the money out. Yeah. I mean, don't forget, listeners, Metro Bank is having to raise that money not because it is financially in difficulty, it's just to make sure that it meets the financial requirements of the regulator so it can withstand an almighty storm that they've modelled for it. Yeah. It's got, admittedly, it's got a loan to deposit ratio of 105%, which is higher than you would like, but it's now met all the capital adequacy requirements. So it's not as if there should be running the bank anymore. And don't forget, your money's protected for the first £85,000 anyway. So you know you don't need to stress the financial services compensation scheme is there to help.
Yeah,
but it's the money. What it needs is it's got expensive funding to keep the regulator happy, and it needed the funding so it could meet its growth. So it actually had some money on its balance sheet to lend out and meet its growth targets, and that's where the story's gone wrong, and that's why the shares have gone from 40 quid to 2 quid. Could somebody buy it? Yes, because it's got 1.9 million customers, it's got £14 billion of deposits, £15 billion of loans. Mm-hmm. Lloyds has just bought the Tesco mortgage book, so they're clearly looking for growth avenues, and that was a £3.7 billion deal. So never say never, but as we all know, one of the golden rules of investment is never buy stock for a bid alone, because, you know, they don't always happen on time, and they don't always happen at the price. You know, people have been telling me that RSA insurance is going to be bid for the last 20 years,
yeah.
Still in the FTSE 100.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's that's a long way. So I'm not saying it won't be. It could be, because the valuation is there, and somebody might think, you know, there's some customers here and some business here. But given that it's had to raise that very expensive debt, I'd imagine if you are the buyer, potential buyer, you can afford to be very, very patient, because this, you know, this company's going to have to recalibrate its growth estimates. It's still got the regulator looking at the books. You know, I don't see why you would rush necessarily.
But I couldn't rule it out. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking, if you are one of, it's not many people going to bid for, I assume, but, you know, say you are Lloyds, maybe there maybe another couple of in the wings somewhere, yeah. And you know the business is deteriorating, and you know why you can rush? Get it a lot cheaper, you know.
There you go.
Exactly. And the outlook, like you said, at the moment for banks not looking very good anyway, just wait. I mean, you want to get it dirt cheap, you know, as much as cheap yeah. as you can. So
Saying it'll be a name your price scenario, but I mean, yeah. At the moment, if there are anybody looking at it, and I've no insight or intel there at all, if it was me, I'd just be prepared to wait, frankly, yeah. Yeah, and see what comes out of the Q4 numbers. And you say the environment's tough, you might just get a chance to pick your price, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, look at Carpetright and Meditor today. I mean, the 5p a share bid's confirmed, but that offer was for, you know, the board have recommended it unanimously. That offer was made first when the share price was at 9p,
yeah.
And the board have still recommended it unanimously.
Yeah.
So, you know, they know the times are tough, and that company probably is better off not being in the public glare. And you may, you know, I don't know, Metro Bank, I think if I was of a strategic bent, I would be prepared. And if I miss it, I'm not going to let fear of missing out as a predator guide me. I think there'd be a price I'd be looking at it, but I'd be prepared to be patient, because at the moment it's, the environment's tough. They've got the regulator breathing on them, checking up, make sure everything's absolutely okay. And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I'd be prepared to wait.
Exactly. I mean, and someone like, you know, Lloyds, they had guys there running the numbers, looking at the thing, and they, well, listen, no rush here. We can wait until they release their next set of figures, which will not be as good as the last set. And,
I think the challenger banks are really interesting, because they've generally all found it very hard to challenge over time.
They've generally been acquired.
You know, Aldermore's been acquired, Shawbrook's been acquired, TSB's been acquired, Charter Court and OS and One Savings Bank have kind of merged. It's been very hard because of this environment. I mean, Challenger Banks, I mean, One Savings Bank, then we're waiting for fresh numbers to come out because of the Charter Court acquisition. The trading statement this week read okay, it's on 1.5x book value, looking at One Savings Bank on a standalone basis. It was on a P/E of 6 with a yield of 4 and a bit, with dividend cover of more than 3x. I mean, when Lloyds bought the Tesco mortgage book, the £3.7 billion price tag, you apply that multiple of assets to One Savings Bank's mortgage book, and you did get kind of twice One Savings Bank's market cap with the non-mortgage books thrown in for good measure. So value hunters, this is not direct recommendations or advice, please, but if you're looking for a challenger bank that, on the face of it, the numbers do stack up, One Savings Bank would be it. We're still waiting to see what the Charter Court numbers do, which I think is why the shares are slightly in stasis right now. But you can soon construct a very strong valuation case for One Savings Bank. You're still waiting for a catalyst, which is probably, you know, yield curve steepening, interest rates not going down a lot, and credit spreads widening. But and people are frightened about the UK mortgage market right now. But, you know, I think, again, in terms of a stock with a lot of potentially bad macro news already priced in, and uncertainty over the charter deal just because of integration, I think One Savings Bank, to me, looks potentially, from a valuation perspective, quite interesting, in the knowledge that you're going to have to be patient and brave.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Ross, thanks for that.
It's a pleasure.
Hopefully we'll catch up next week.
I look forward to it very much. Have a great weekend.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, KEFI Minerals, KEFI, up 6.46% to 1.8 pennies. At four, AFC Energy, just took a survey out on those actually, that they've done 200% in the last 10 trading days. And I said, can I go higher from here on the survey on Twitter? So up 20% a day to 16.24 pence. At three, Inspirit Energy, up 120%, really? Wow. It's INSP at 0.2 pence. At two, Echo Energy, Echo Atlantic, Eco Orlando Oil and Gas, not Echo. Echo is the sort of ticker of all, ECO. It's the bounce off for 3 days. When you see a company, you know, falling off a cliff for some reason, wait 3 days. Normally it'll rally. 13% up, 56.5 pence there. And at number one again is Tissue Regenics. Today it's down, but it's had a good run over the last 5-6 days. Down 7.55% to 1.225 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Europa Metals. Of course, Lawrence on the podcast, talking about drilling, mobilization, and operational update. At four, KEFI Minerals, development of Ethiopian mining skill base. At three, Riverfort, quarterly update. That's Riverfort Global Opportunities. Quarterly update to the 31st of September 2019. At two, Zoetic, issue of equity. Number one, most liked RNS, is ready? Enconesi Energy, Holdings and Company. Aren't there any more exciting RNSs than that? Holdings. Scott Fletcher again, he's up to 14.089% in stock there now at Enconesi. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.